Hi, everyone. Welcome to Talk Recovery Radio, coming to you live on Zoom today, not from the studio. Hey, Darren, how's it going?
Good to see your face.
Yeah, good to see your face as well, everybody. Welcome to Talk Recovery Radio, coming to you live every Thursday. If you're listening to us on the radio, you're listening to us on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio. And thanks to Kimmett for rebroadcasting our shows. Studio's closed right now due to COVID. Can't have all those people in those tight quarters in the studio. Looking forward to getting back into the studio. Darren, how you been?
Very well.
Very well. Great, great, great.
No complaints. Oh,
my name is incorrect on my thing. Let me just put here Giuseppe. I'm not Jared. I must have logged in as Jared. There we go. So we come to you live. You can catch us on Facebook, which if you're watching us live, obviously you can, you know, our Facebook page, but go to talkrecoveryradio.com and, you know, 6 years of shows, hundreds of guests, and thanks to everyone that's been listening to our show. I really appreciate both that. And we've got our first guest already on screen. I hit admit all. So welcome to the show, Sarah. At this point, though, we'd like to just talk about some hot topics going on, and I just wanted to make an announcement for those of you that follow our Facebook page. We've started a campaign called Recovery Month Canada. Darren, not sure if you saw that, but we need you. We need you if you're listening and you're watching. So we're doing this big campaign. Go to recoverymonthcanada.ca. Many people don't know it, but the federal government does not recognize Recovery Day, does not recognize Recovery Month. And we're going after the same way that Pride did, where now there's a Pride Month and Pride Days are recognized by the federal government and so forth. It's a really big deal because Health Canada really doesn't look at recovery from addiction as something. And so that's why Recovery Month is really important. They've actually have said no. And so the goal now is to petition every MP, member of parliament in Canada. We need 40 MPs to vote yes. And it's not a policy change. It's just an optic, like just support the idea of Recovery Month. And the future will, you know, unveil what that means. One day, hopefully every monument, you know, in a city gets lit up purple, just like they light up the rainbow colors for Pride and other health events and so forth. So it's a really big deal. All you have to do, go to recoverymonthcanada.ca. Instructions are there. One, there's a petition, so please sign it. Two, there's a form letter that all you got to do is download it and send it. And everybody knows how to use computers, send it to their local MP. And if you don't know who your local MP is, there's a link on the site that helps you find your local MP. MPs need to hear from their constituents or they just ain't going to care. That's just the way it is. So please go to recoverymonthcanada.ca. Just take 5 minutes out of your day and you can be part of history and making Recovery Month something to talk about, just like people did with Pride decades ago. It's time we let people know that, you know, the 171 people that died last month in British Columbia alone, like they need to be reminded. You know, we need to remind ourselves that recovery is possible and prevention and so many other recovery methods can help save lives. Thanks. Darren, who do we got on the show today?
Yes, again, welcome to Talk Recovery. Our first guest is Sarah Summers. Welcome to the show. She has recently authored Saving Sarah, a memoir of food addiction. Along with a career in psychotherapy, Sarah, we would like to talk about food addiction, disorders, and obviously your story of recovery. I see you're in Paris.
I do. I live in Paris now.
I would love to be stuck in Paris right now.
That is what recovery brings. Wildest dreams come true.
So we're Western Canada. What are we, 9 hours?
9 hours. It's 9 o'clock here in Paris.
Oh, perfect. Good, good. Well, welcome to the show. I want to talk, you know, there's two terms that come up in this topic, food addiction and food disorder. When I think of food disorder, I think of anorexia, bulimia, you know, the compulsive behaviors around food and eating and body appearance. When I hear food addiction, I think of being addicted like a drug, like to one specific food. And I guess, is there a separation in these terms? You know, if somebody is, you know, diagnosed with a food disorder, like, is there also food addiction? Are they two separate things?
Well, this is, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert, except for on my own.
Just your own opinion, yeah.
So I think that in my case, that I am allergic, addicted to sugar and carbohydrates in both liquid and hard form. And that when they enter my body, the exact same thing happens. I am off and running. And I have disordered eating when that, there's nothing orderly about my eating once those things, those ingredients are in my body.
Can you tell us a little bit about what your food addiction looked like, and did it manifest? Were there forms of bulimia, anorexia? Like, how, what did it look like in your case?
Well, in my opinion, there's like three levels of food addiction, and binging, the binge disorder, this is in the DSM-5, binge disorder eating, is probably they're none easy to recover from, but that's probably the easier. And then bulimia, and it doesn't just mean vomiting, it means somehow trying to get those calories out any which way you can. So we have people that go to the gym for 4 hours.
Right.
Anorexia, in my opinion, is a whole other animal. It's a very serious, not just disordered not eating, but a disordered, you look in the mirror and see a fat person when you're dying of starvation. And it's very, very difficult to recover from. My own journey, I was a binger, but not for lack of trying to vomit. I really wanted to learn how to do that. And I'm very glad that I didn't learn it, because it can destroy your teeth. It can destroy everything inside of you, the acid. And I believe I was born a compulsive eater. I binged from as long as I can remember. And then I tried to manage it. And we all know about wonderful unmanageability.
Yes.
So I tried many, many ways to manage it. I probably tried every diet in kingdom come, except I didn't have my stomach stapled or anything put in it. I was too scared of knives and needles. And so I came upon Grace Eaters Anonymous, and being a member of that other program, I found it to be most like that other program, that it was very black and white, no matter what, and for that, I found it very hard, and then I didn't. I went through a lot of years of just relapsing, and then one day, I gave up the ghost, and I think my higher power took pity on me, to tell you the truth. And I've had a very good recovery for the last 11, 15 years.
And I was reading some of your information on your website, and it was the very first time, and I've been around 12-step programs and all other models, you know, throughout not only my own addiction, but my recovery as well. I have never heard of Gray Sheet Anonymous. So I do want to talk a little bit more about that and who it can benefit more specifically. But it also says you were, you know, your addiction was from 9 years old.
That's what the publicist put on the book. But in fact, I think my memory really starts around 8 or 9. I don't have many memories. And I think that's why she said that. But I know that I've never had a normal relationship with a bite of food.
So I'm wondering, because I know a lot of people who have recovered, have children, and there's this sort of unconscious or possibly conscious obsession with, oh, that behavior right there, my child is expressing an addiction, they're going to become an addict like me. And there's that sort of fear. What is it that isn't just maybe, you know, a 9 or 10 year old child that just loves sweets? Like, what is it that maybe you can look back in hindsight and really see that this was more so problematic and would lead to unhealthy food problems?
That is a great question. It's one I've asked myself. If I had had more loving parenting, would I have crossed the line or not? Because, I mean, kids eat too much and they love sugar and not a whole, there are some kids, but they're not many. And in college, people drink too much, but they don't all turn into alcoholics. You just don't know then. And it's not a good idea to diagnose other people. There is some research, however, that if women have become food addicts and have too much sugar and junk in their bodies, it will get into the baby, either in the amnio inside or through the milk. So there is some research that you can pass it down, and those mothers, well, I think they just pray to their higher power for help. I mean, I don't know that diagnosing helps anything, because what are you going to do? The kid's just going to start feeling more ashamed of their behavior, and that is the worst thing possible.
And so, you know, to second part to that question, at what age would, you know, intervening be, you know, maybe without a diagnosis, or, you know, when at what age would it really show as this is going to destroy your life?
Well, I think probably in my case, you know, around 10 to 13, when I started getting cognition and was aware of my friends and that I wasn't the same size as my friends, I think some intervention could have happened then. And I think in their own way they tried, but it was just an unknown factor. I mean, when I was a child, alcoholism was barely known. So
right.
My mother had no patience with, you know, you make up your mind and then you do it. And she could do that. And neither one of her daughters could.
Yeah.
So
the pressure under that style of parenting is intense, because you just don't think, you know, there's something wrong with me. I can't do it like as easy as people are suggesting it can be done.
From that time on, that's exactly what happened. Everything I did, it kept getting worse because I was criticized for it and the shame built up. And
right. So it sounds, I mean, obviously that, you know, the generation that you were, you know, going through these struggles, it must have acquired a lot of information, a lot of knowledge, a lot of, you know, understanding, and then some time to go by for some recognition to this being a food addiction, and, you know, then what specifically you need to abstain from, or what eating habits absolutely have to change. You mentioned sugar, grains, and starches. Again, something I've never heard, for people's recovery. I've often wondered, what is it that one with food addiction has to abstain from? And is it always the same? Like, an alcoholic obviously has to abstain from alcohol and everything else, mind and mood altering.
Exactly.
What is the
beauty of Grace Eaters Anonymous is that there's a food plan. And in fact, it was the original food plan for Overeaters Anonymous. And then Overeaters Anonymous started to expand and started getting interested in nutrition and had, well, I don't know how many food plans it has now, but this is the original food plan, and it's printed on a gray sheet. So it's a very affectionate name. And as it turns out, it's the only anonymous program that has the solution in the title and doesn't have the problem in the title. And that's why you've never heard of it, because it's not something you think of. So I get this food plan and I get a sponsor, and they tell me, you never make an independent decision, Sarah. I'm going to, you eat this amount of food and this amount of hours between meals, and you don't eat these things. And darn, I never got a craving by not, when I didn't eat those things, I never had a craving. It was just like alcohol being lifted. So for me, it is the easier, softer way. I have to use a scale at every meal, and I am fine with that because it feels like that's my protection. That's my defense against the first bite.
Right.
And it's the easier, softer way. I don't have to think about how much is this too much? Is this too little? Is this, this, all that ping pong game, or as Bill W. said, the debating society, it's gone. It's gone.
And so, that, sorry, go ahead, Giuseppe.
So in, you know, I'm hearing you talk, and I'm around addiction every day. I'm also around recovery every day. And I'm around a lot of new people. And when someone's coming in from drug addiction, you can tell, you know, it's just like, yeah, there's something going on there. And I don't mean to sound judgmental. When you think of food addiction, you think of overweight, or you think of someone too skinny. And you look very healthy. And so my question is, does everybody with a food addiction either have to be, you know, overweight or underweight, or were you really underweight in the beginning or overweight?
I was never underweight. I was always overweight.
You were overweight. Okay.
I was never, you know, I don't know how to answer what for everybody, because this is what worked for me. I think I was a low bottom eater. I've taken the recovery words that I can live with now. I hated those words when I first came in. But obesity is the number two killer in the United States.
This brings you to my next question, you know, diabetes, obesity. Does it bother you that everyone's talking about it's good that they're talking about it, but everyone's talking about the overdose crisis. Everyone's talking about fentanyl. Alcohol kills just as many people. No one talks about it. Diabetes kills even more people. No one talks about it. Obesity is killing so many people. Isn't it like, do you feel like, hey, like let's stop talking about fentanyl and let's talk about addiction. Let's talk about what really is going on. Like people needing to fill these voids up and people not content with life or whatever it can be.
I have been trained to keep my eyes on my own plate.
And oh, wow. That means.
So I actually don't think in terms of stop talking about this, talk about this. But the reason for writing the book was I knew there was nothing like it out there. I'm a reader, so I knew. And I thought, okay, this is my primary purpose. I've got to get the message out there that there is something that worked for me. And if people read it and identify, maybe the solution that worked for me will work for them.
And the book is called Saving Sarah, A Memoir About Food Addiction. So tell us about the book. So is it for somebody to just get information? Is it going to help somebody with food addiction? Is it some exercises in there?
Memoir, and mostly it's my before story. I wanted to write it for four audiences. One for a suffering compulsive food addict out there I didn't know other people ate like I did. We don't talk about it. And so I wanted to put it out there. And I think a lot of people are buying it and identifying, whether they come to Overeaters Anonymous or Grace Eaters Anonymous, I don't know. There's no way for me to track that. But I also wanted to write it for educators and for doctors and for therapists, because having been one for most of my adult life, there's not enough information. I mean, you really don't know what to look for when kids are told they're just undisciplined. Well, that sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. Addicts are undisciplined, but therapists and educators and doctors don't read the same literature you and I do. And so that was my other hope. And I've been getting some feedback that therapists are reading it and really liking it and grateful. Somebody emailed me today and said they'd gotten the recommendation of their book, my book, from Overeaters Anonymous, knowing that they were in another program. So I think the word, and I was reviewed today in the San Francisco Chronicle, a very nice review. So thank you. And so we'll see, you know, it's just, how do you get the word out there? And that's, you know, I think people are more talking about the pandemic than anything at this point. Yeah.
I've got one more question, then I'll let Darren take over. So I have a loved one that it's clearly obvious that they have some type of problem with food, whether overeating, undereating. There's, you know, like everyone in the world knows you have a problem but you. How does one support a loved one? You know, there's the whole idea of enabling when it comes to alcohol or drug use. There's the idea of tough love. There's the idea of Naranon and Al-Anon. What's in the world when it comes to food addiction? How do you support somebody that may have?
You're asking the $1 million question, right? Because when people tried to help me, I heard it as criticism. So I didn't listen. I couldn't listen. I mean, just everything went shut down. I have been told one instance where somebody bought the book and left it in their loved one's house and she read it. So what she's going to do with it, nobody knows. But I don't know how you help someone if they're in denial. You know, I pray to my higher power a lot, just give me the answer, and different answers for different people. It's a tough one. It's really tough.
It is, because you're always just working on the response from that individual who is most likely minimizing, justifying, rationalizing, hiding completely. Even when the addiction is as obvious as it can be, it's what's the approach? You know, leave a book, very soft, hopefully get a discussion out of it, or come in hard, intervene, take away all, you know, sort of options and apply some consequences. There's never one right answer, is there? How did you find recovery? How was it approached to you? Like you said, you were in denial. What woke you up?
What woke me up? Well, my sister found it first. She was at Harvard and it started in Cambridge. And so she wrote me about it. And 4 years later, I went to visit her and she took me to a meeting and I had some competition issues with my sister. So I wasn't about to do what she was going to do.
Right on.
So I got myself into a nice box where I couldn't do something that turned out to be the solution, because my pride was huge. Mm-hmm. So I had to go into that other program first. And I think it was somewhere after many years that it was like a light bulb went on and it just said, you're going to die of this. You've been offered the solution. You've gone to these meetings, you know, a number of people. You can keep pretending, but.
Yeah. That's always the story.
I think my higher power took pity on me. I mean,
yeah, it's similar to my story. Just an individual time in space, you know, that it wasn't anything new, no new information, but just things aligned where it was overwhelmingly powerful that, you know.
It was. And it's very hard. I don't think it matters what eating program you go in for solution to learn how to eat differently, to change 180 degrees it's like learning a new language, but you know, with a whole new alphabet. And so it's, you really do have to be, I'm going to die from this. I have a friend who says, you're at the corner of hope and desperation. I hope you pick hope. And so I ended the book by saying I was one of the lucky ones, and I feel that way. I just think, you know, unless the word starts getting out there more and more, and alcoholism is sort of on everybody's, everybody knows one, but it's until I think food addiction becomes more of a household word, there are going to be people dying, and they won't know there is food addiction. It will be diabetes, or it will be something else. And
yeah, so, there's rarely a case of a food overdose death. It's always, you know, this third, fourth symptom that society just sort of deems as a natural cause.
Although we do have examples like Elvis and Mama Cass both died binging. So you can die from binging.
And that brings the intensity to food addiction, food disorders, whatever your specific behaviors are, of how intense that realm is in addictions. I mean, drug addiction is always specified, you know, heroin's really, really bad, and, you know, the detox is different, and what's worse, and it really doesn't matter. You know, it's just this thing that's taking and stripping away all sense of happiness out of the individual. You say, and so what I'm thinking is, the alcoholic that quits drinking, no more parties, no more celebrations. What is it like for a food, you know, like you're measuring your food. Is there moments of enjoyment for you if you are abstaining from those foods that sort of brought that, you know, endorphin?
There are not only moments of enjoyment. I was one of those people who thought food was the enemy. And I hated food. I hated eating. And I was always eating out of boxes and cartons and all. I didn't eat any good food. So one of the things I had to learn was to enjoy my food. And I learned it. And I feel I get an abundance of food. I just don't get, and I think sugar is a drug. And you put sugar and carbohydrates together and you've got an amazing drug. But I go down to my corner vegetable market here in Paris, and I can eat everything that I see. And it's beautiful and it's gorgeous. And I don't miss it. I mean, it's a miracle. I mean, I'm not somebody who uses that word lightly. I don't miss it. So, because I get such good food to eat, and I love my meals.
I was just, you know, thinking of the envious of, you know, living in Paris right now. And then I'm thinking, what I would be wanting to experience food wise is probably what you're avoiding on a daily basis. But isn't that, it happened for me. And, you know, where it's just this cautious, you know, I can't go here, I can't go there. And perhaps that's the way it has to be in the beginning. But when you're through, I really believe to be in the term of recovery is that it's not like that. You see what's enjoyable to you. You can see your options. You can relish in it, really, for lack of a better term.
And I do. Somewhere in our literature, it says that you get into a place of safety where you're neither tempted or want to. And I feel that way. I feel I could pretty much go anywhere if I have a good reason to go there. I mean, it's not different from alcohol. And it couldn't have happened in the first 2 or 3, 4 years. I didn't have any confidence that the rug wouldn't be pulled out. I thought maybe I was Charlie Brown and somebody was going to pull that football out. But it didn't happen. And here I am. And I can't imagine a bottle of wine or a patisserie that I would trade what I've got today for. I can't, there's nothing.
That's
so
it.
It's okay.
that is the solution. That's what we hope to fight for, you know, with for us, Recovery Month becoming, you know, a really supported thing through the government all over Canada. That's what we hope for people, not just strictly harm reduction, but that, you know, that route to get to that spot that everybody, I believe, has the right to experience. I'm only experienced with, you know, the 12-step programs in Narcotics Anonymous. I know how many resources is out there for that. I'm curious, because is there as many people recovered through food addiction that are putting their stories out there, such as yourself, that are, you know, meeting in Zoom meetings right now? How much do you know about that? And
well, we have lots of Zoom meetings, 3, 4, 5 a day. You know, if anybody, I went on your website, so I know that you don't deal with food addiction, but if anybody, any of your listeners want to know more about Grace Sheeters Anonymous, the website is www.gracesheet.org. I have a blog, like, which I guess you went on, because I'm doing a webinar with this wonderful place called Eating Disorders Hope. You may have heard of it. They also have Addictions Hope. And so there's information. The blog is saving-sarah.org, and they can get information about that webinar. It'd be similar to what we're doing now, just a conversation, but more. I think there are going to be a couple of doctors there who work in food addiction and can talk more about the medical side of it also. Well, we have company.
We have company, yes.
Well, just, Sarah Summers, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for, great. You guys are great. And I guess you have to be a Canadian citizen to... I don't have an MP. I still vote in California. So
well, if you have any Canadian friends, you know, let them know what we're doing.
And I do.
Send them an email, recoverymonthcanada.ca. Just send them the link. All the details are there. Okay. And say, you got to get on this.
And maybe someday in the United States, we have hope.
No, the United States has a Recovery Month. They designated Recovery Month in the United States years ago.
I'll look that up. I didn't know that. Yep, thank you. Yeah,
the U.S. did.
Well, thank you, you guys. You were great.
Thank you for being on the show.
This is Talk Recovery Radio, Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. If you are listening via the radio station, welcome back on Facebook. That was our first guest, Sarah Summers.
That was a great show. That was great. I had no idea about that. What's it called? Gray Sheet?
Gray Sheets Anonymous.
Yeah, and you have to weigh your food.
And sugar, grains, and starches, man. It makes sense.
I know. I don't think I could do it. No. Like, I can't even, like, stop. Even on the cutting board, I eat. So, anyway, you're listening to Talk Recovery Radio, powered by New West Recovery, which is made up of Last Door and Westminster House, Canada's recovery community. You can catch all of our shows at talkrecoveryradio.com. And like Darren just said, if you're listening to us on the radio, that's Vancouver Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening. We're doing Facebook Live right now because the studio is closed due to COVID. Really hoping it opens soon and it's safe for all of us to be in the studio. We have our second guest on the show. Hello, we got Chris Hamilton on the show.
How's it going? Chris.
Not bad. Welcome to Talk Recovery Radio.
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. And we've got a Canadian hip hop artist who's in recovery, and yes. We want to welcome you to the show, Chris. Ill Tone is your stage name?
It is, for sure. Yeah, I came by it naturally. My last name is Hamilton, so people used to call me Hamilton, and then finally Ill Tone just stuck. It sounds a little bit more appealing than Hamilton does, so yeah.
Right on. That's pretty cool. And how long ago was that?
Well, this was a long time ago. So I've been emceeing since I was about 12 years old. I used to go by a different name, and that actually came about when I was about 17 years old. My last name was just something childish and not very appealing. And so one of my buddies that I used to rhyme with in a group called Broken Logic renamed me Hamilton. It's a little bit more natural than the old one was. So,
And just for location wise, you're from where?
I'm from the Comox Valley originally, okay. Just over here on Vancouver Island, but currently I'm actually living in Nanaimo in a recovery house. So I'm still in the treatment bubble, as we call it. So yeah. I'm up here for the foreseeable future. I've got 15 months under my belt right now. So thank you very much. Yeah.
And you're with our friends over at Edgewood.
Yes, I am. So I went through Edgewood actually in May to September of last year. I did 3.5 months, including the extended care portion. I'm still finishing up my aftercare there right now. Obviously, things are a little bit shut down as far as, you know, outpatient care just because of the COVID-19 situation. But once things return to normal, I will be finishing up with my aftercare there. So I still do counseling, group therapy, things like that. But I'm also fully immersed in the Narcotics Anonymous community here in Nanaimo as well. I'm a group service representative for the NA Nooner. I go to, you know, 3 to 5 meetings a week, and I do some AA meetings as well. So just, yeah, whatever floats your boat. Each fellowship, you know, there are principles that are crossover in each, whichever meetings I like, I tend to go to. I don't discriminate based on which A it is, right?
So. Yeah. We all go through that phase though.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, totally. All right, so it sounds all great. Like you're living the dream.
Totally.
Like, was it always like that? So it says you took a 5-year hiatus. Obviously, there's a reason you went to rehab and still in rehab. So yeah, this is a bit of the personal story part of our show. And obviously, we're not asking you what your step four is unless you really want to tell us. But you know, I work in a rehab center as well. And like almost every 2 weeks, we get a hip hop artist showing up, you know, like everyone's a rapper, everyone's a musician. And, you know, that's fantastic. Like show your art, right? So here you are, you show up and you're this hip hop guy and you actually have, you know, talent and you've got a history. What happened? Like, did the club scene get to you? Was it out in the open? Were you a mess on stage? So many performers show up to recovery and they're like, my life is over. I can never do a show again. I can't do this 12-step stuff because like I got to go to clubs. So like what happened and what are you going through with all that?
Well, I mean, my chemical dependency issues are very deep-seated. So I began using substances at an early age. And one of the underlying defects that I think led to this and something that I had to work through in treatment is social anxiety. And when one chooses a artistic hobby that involves putting oneself out there on a daily basis via, you know, even just rapping in front of people, never mind getting on stage in front of 1,000 people or whatever, just putting yourself out there like we do, it's, you know, it's nerve-wracking for sure. And when I suffer from social anxiety, I always saw that as a way to be more outgoing, and not just in the context of art and hip-hop, but just in any social situation. So I would use that, you know, that drink or that joint or whatever it was as a social crutch. So, you know, nervous, take a sip, nervous, take a sip. Eventually I was loose enough that I could interact with people. But what ended up happening is, you know, what I was using to make me less socially anxious, I turned a corner at some point and was it led to me getting up and doing damage control. What did I say to this person last night? You know, who did I yell at? What does my family think of me? Why did I wake up in the drunk tank? Things like that. So what started out as being something to alleviate my social anxiety led to being the source of it. So my whole life revolved around this damage control. And yeah, you called it like bombing shows on stage. I had one show. It was a fairly local show over in Vancouver where I was like, okay, you know, just 3 beers before I get up on stage. That's it. I'll be able to remember my lyrics. Well, you know, 10 beers deep, I get up on stage and I screwed up every song. It was so embarrassing. I could never look the promoter in the eye again after that. I've done that a number of times. It's not just one show. It's, you know, entire weeks of performances, things that I worked for a month to plan and carry out that are just gone. Snap of your fingers like that because of chemical dependency, right? So, yeah, you nailed it. Every reason you listed is what led me into treatment. My 5-year hiatus as well. Yeah, I just decided that I couldn't do it anymore and just quit because I had had a relapse. I previously had 2.5 years clean and was out on tour in Norway. And a beautiful woman offered me a beer. I took it and that was it. 2.5 years down the drain. 2 weeks later, I was 20 beers deep. Upon returning to Canada, it took, you know, 2 nights for me to get back into harder drugs too.
Yeah, it's the story of so many. Are you so you're at the tail end of your treatment approach, and you had some clean time before the entertainment industry. Obviously, COVID's changed everything. So let's just take the COVID out of it, and hopefully everything gets back to normal. Is there this fear that you might have? Like, are they like, are people accepting? Everyone talks about stigma. So I'll just get right to the question. Everyone talks about, you know, addiction is stigmatizing and the stigma kills people. And I'm not really a big fan of that conversation. I like the stigma of recovery is pretty strong. And so like, what is going to happen when you go back out there? Like, are your friends that you MC with, you know, that are smoking weed? Like, how do you prepare yourself for that? Where it's just like, yo, man, like, you're going to ask them not to smoke? Or are you going to say, you know, how many times can you pass it without taking a puff? So what's your plans for that?
So I kind of agree with you that I don't think there's a social stigma to the negative regarding recovery. I think that there's enough information out there now that a lot of people, even the normies, as I like to call them, understand, you know, there is that certain percentage of the population that we have this pre-existing, you know, chemical dependency issue. So once we start, we can't stop. So I'm not going to let the social stigma aspect on that level bother me at all. But it is certainly nerve-wracking to go back into the bar and club scene as a performer, knowing that eventually this is what got me last time. You know what I mean? I have this saying, if you hang around, you know, a Mexican restaurant for long enough, we're going to eat Mexican food, right? If you're in a bar for long enough, you're going to have a beer. So for me, the things that have changed this time around, for one, last time I cleaned up, and I say that in quotations, I didn't participate in any recovery related activities. I didn't do 12-step fellowship meetings. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't take on sponsees. I didn't work the steps. I didn't do counseling. I didn't do anything. I was just white knuckling it through it for 2.5 years. So this time I've, you know, cut out a lot of the old bad influences of my life. I know I'm powerless over people, places, and things. So I'm not going to ask my, you know, hip hop friends to not use around me. I'm just not going to be around those people. I'm blessed, thankfully, with having a DJ, my old DJ, who didn't drink and smoke around me, just knowing what I had been through. He understood it. I never needed to explain it to him, right? So I think by cutting a lot of those old people out of my life, it will be a lot easier now when I roll to a show, especially here in Nanaimo, where I built a strong recovery network. The large portion of the people that are coming out to see me will be a tight-knit sober crew. So that's good to have that accountability while I'm in the bar and club scene. Now, I haven't really thought too far ahead to if I go on tour again, which, you know, is pretty imminent. It will probably happen at some point. I will be going back out on tour. I haven't really thought about what I'm going to do there, but I think that, you know, every community has recovery in it, from the smallest little town to the largest city. As long as I link in with those people when I show up, maybe not even on the level that they're coming out to support me at my shows, but as long as I, you know, take the time to go to an NA Nooner or an AA Nooner before I go out to perform that night, I'll probably be able to maintain my my recovery while I'm out on the road.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be awful if the story was you have to give up that type of talent, you know, in order to, you know, save your recovery. Can't hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Can you hear?
Yep, I got you back now. Yeah.
I was saying it would be a horrible attraction if we were told we have to give up these talents and skills that we have in order to recover. However, not everybody's, you know, talents and skills, like you say, bring them into an atmosphere where there's drinking and using. It's going to really rely on the individual's sort of purpose and why am I here and why am I doing this to have a change. I'm not very familiar with your career as a hip hop artist, but I would assume that prior to getting clean, you know, you weren't really thinking of the spiritual aspect of lyrics and, you know, all of those notions of life and benefit. Has that changed? And are you now writing music that is sort of spiritually fulfilling for you and has a message of that in it?
Absolutely. So with my last release, I actually did write it during a period of cleanliness. So like I said, I wasn't participating too much in the recovery community. So a lot of it is written from the perspective of struggling, but hoping to triumph over the struggles, right? But there is a lot of negativity in it. So I have a song called Clubs and Drugs, for example, that's about exactly what we were just talking about, existing in the club scene as a sober individual and looking around with all the triggers around me and trying to, you know, navigate my way through a night without relapsing. This time around, I've written actually my next EP, my next album is written. It's a lot more positive sounding and I didn't really plan that. I just kind of started writing and then looked back on it like, this is a lot more positive than the last stuff that I wrote. Not that it was fully negative or anything like that, but you know what I mean? Like I just looked back on it like, these songs sound a lot funner. It's a lot different sounding from my last stuff, which, you know, like I said, I did highlight the triumph aspect of it because I did have 2.5 years, but in 2.5 years last time there, I didn't have, you know, as much spiritual fulfillment as I have this time at 15 months by having just partaken in recovery activities, having friends, forming a stronger relationship with my family again, as a result of having cleaned up, attending the meetings, et cetera, et cetera. I feel more spiritually fulfilled than I did last time, you know, with 2.5 years, just because it wasn't real recovery last time. It was just, I got to get through the night, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I see... you know, those with notoriety come out of the I'm a drug addict closet and, you know, openly admit that they've vastly improved their life and whatever, whether it was, you know, they go to meetings or whatever, but just that they're sober now or clean now. I just think how helpful that is to all the people that watch them, that follow their lives. And, you know, when you listen to them and they've gotten into that confidence of making that change and they will not become who they were for their audience or the sake of their, you know, acquiring gigs and whatnot. It's inspiring. And I've only noticed like a rise in their own talent and like just a more pure skill and artistry behind it. Has that had an impact on your life and your direction?
I think that another thing that crushed me last time is I spent so much time in my addictive lifestyle that I just didn't have time. Like it's a big job, you know, like, I used to just look at this when I was just a fan, like, wow, people just make music and then they put it out and then we hear it. But it's there's a lot of steps that have to transpire to get the music from my brain to your ears, right? Yeah. And I just didn't have the time or the drive for it anymore. So one thing that's different now, having cleaned up, is A, I have all this time that I used to spend on my addiction to put into something more positive. And B, I just have the motivation to do it because I'm not waking up, you know, strung out from the night before. And I, you know, have the drive to do it. I have my personality's coming back. I was void of all personality towards the end there. And that was one reason also why I stopped creating, was just because, you know, what was I going to put in the music other than what I was doing, getting, using, and then doing damage control the next day. Like I was just all out of ideas for with which to create. So now, you know, I've got a clear mind. I've got a clear conscience having worked the steps. My life has many more positive aspects in it to write about. I've got, you know, the creativity is flowing. There's loads of time, and you know, people are more apt to support somebody who's a positive influence on their surroundings rather than somebody who's an energy vampire who walks into a social situation with one goal to, you know, get drugs, use them, and then to, you know, wherever the night goes from there. That was like,
I like how you said energy vampire. I had no idea about that idea. Like suck the life out of the room. Like that's what we do when we're in our addiction. It's like, oh, there he is, you know, like whether it's the Christmas dinner or the family dinner, or even just, you know, with friends, it's like, there he is. Right. You know, Darren, you can keep talking. I just want to let you know, I'm going to try and play your clubs and drugs video in the background. And sometimes, you know, because of the Facebook Live, it gets frozen. But we'll see what happens.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Might feedback too. Never thought about that.
Oh, it's all good. No worries.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we were in the studio, we'd be definitely cranking some of your tunes.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. If we were in the studio, for sure. Can you see that, Darren?
I can see it.
Yeah. So what goes on now? Like, you know, Darren talked to you about, you know, the change in music and so forth. I mean, that's a plus. Like people that find recovery, it like gives them that opportunity to like, you know, change the direction of your music to help people. Like Eminem has done it, you know, many performers have done it. Is that, you know, the pathway you're going?
Yeah, so my next EP release actually isn't going to be as recovery centered as this one. Strangely enough, like I said, my last one was because I was in the grips of my addiction and I did speak from a place of triumph. There is a little bit of it in there, but it's a different path. A lot of the, you know, songs that I make are written from a place of struggle. The next one won't be written from as much of a place of struggle, but on that note, I don't make any bones about it. When I go into a recovery-based meeting or anything like that, I do let people know that I'm a hip-hop artist in recovery. It's the first thing in my bio. And if anybody's ever wanting to talk or needs a source of inspiration and hope, I'm more than willing to sit in on interviews like this or answer their questions directly or converse with them one-on-one. I wanted to make something with the next one that's a little bit different from what I've just made. And since this is so recovery, struggle, and triumph based, I wanted to take it in a new direction. That's not to say that I won't go back to writing about recovery in the future. I'm sure it will come up. I'm kind of just the type of guy that writes about whatever he's feeling on the day of. And, you know, when I'm immersing myself, like 90% of my life right now takes place in recovery. I'm just out of treatment within the last year. So I'm sure it will come up again. But the songs that I've just written since the onset of COVID-19, there's maybe one or two out of the six that deal with recovery. There's one of the songs actually deals specifically with struggling with the aspect of a higher power, which is something that used to be prevalent in my life and is not as much so today. So it's there. It's just not as prominent as on the last release.
I'm going to turn it up just for, so you can hear it, right, Darren?
Can you hear it? I think unless the video is supposed to be a little glitchy, it's a bit glitchy.
It's a little bit glitchy, for sure.
Right. Okay. So where can people find all your music and videos and so forth?
Totally. So I am on YouTube. You can search youtube.com/illtonesmusic. You can also find me on instagram.com/illtonesmusic, facebook.com/illtonesmusic, and also search for me on Spotify. Just look up Illtone on Spotify. If you follow my profile there, you're going to get notifications on upcoming releases as well as.
That's just cut out there at the very end.
We just cut out
all that information. Just before you stopped talking, it cut out your audio.
There you are. Hello.
There we are. What point did I cut out there? Sorry about that.
So your YouTube channel, Spotify.
Yeah, Instagram, Facebook, all the above. You can search me on there and connect with me. And if you want to reach out, feel free to send me a message. And I'm always quick to get back to supporters, people in the recovery community, haters, anybody who wants to contact me. I'll answer your questions with a smile. So.
And can you do me a favor? Find out who your local MP is and send them a letter. Not sure if you caught up the beginning of the show. Before we end our show, I'm going to do a shout out. RecoveryMonthCanada.ca. Go to the website. There's three really simple instructions. First one is sign the petition. The second one is find your MP. That's Member of Parliament. They make the decisions in Ottawa. Really? And the third instruction is download the letter and send it off to them. Put your signature on it. And it's asking members of Parliament to vote on Motion 40, which is to officially proclaim September as Recovery Month Canada. Other countries around the world are making September Recovery Month. The goal is that purple is the color of recovery that's come out of the States, and we've adopted it here in Canada. And just like they've done with Pride Month, we're trying to do the same thing with Recovery Month, where cities have their own recovery days. Recovery Month has no definition of recovery. You're in recovery when you say you are. Your recovery journey is yours, not ours. And we just want people to talk more about recovery and less about addiction, and maybe that can get out of this overdose crisis. So if you could do us that favor, contact your MP, share it on your page as well, recoverymonthcanada.ca. Thanks for being on the show, Chris. We really appreciate it. Best wishes with your music career, and say hello to our friends at Edgewood. A lot of my friends work there, and a lot of my friends have been there.
Mine too. Current,
yeah. You know, yeah. So
technically, I'm an alumnus there too.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Yeah. So shout out to Edgewood. Talk Recovery Radio, powered by New West Recovery, which is made up of Last Door and Westminster House, Canada's recovery community. Vancouver Co-op Radio, thanks for letting us be on your airways. And Darren, any final thoughts?
I'm just thinking of the people that I have, whether I'm into the style of music or whatever artistry, those that have shared their authentic selves throughout their journey are the ones that I would go to a show, I would buy their art in a second before, you know, the guy that doesn't want to hinder his reputation and meanwhile is on the path to just another artist dead, you know, not just because of the drug, but because they were so afraid of, you know, putting themselves out there in an authentic way. So yeah, best of luck with your health and recovery, obviously, furthest and foremost, and totally your career and in the music as well, man. And we'll have a performer for Recovery Day at some point if we get that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Again.
I'm in.
So all right, keep perfect. It up, pal. Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Okay,
thanks for listening, everyone. Check out Illtone on Facebook, social media. He's on our Talk Recovery pages. Just click on the links. And see you next Thursday. And thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.